If you have concerns or ideas for our community hospital, Holy Cross, maybe you'd like to be on this committee. Hi, this is Nancy Staff from your Northern New Mexico newsroom. The Taos Town Council is looking for people who want to serve on a new community hospital study committee. The council this week unanimously approved the formation of the committee and is asking the community to apply or turn in nominations for people to be on the committee. The membership committee will include two council representatives, two county commission representatives, two hospital board representatives, two hospital workers, union representatives, two local doctors, two Taos County Intergovernmental Council representatives, and one knowledgeable consumer representative. If you're interested in serving on the study committee or know someone who is, please send an email with the nominee's name, position of interest, and contact information to the town clerk. That's Renee Lucero at rlucero@taosgov.com. Nominations are due no later than noon on Monday, November 11th. Taking the scare out of healthcare and Holy Cross Hospital from your community radio station, 1340 KVOT, Taos. Special edition of Breakfast with Nancy, and I'm glad he could come in. There are a lot of questions, concerns, probably some answers, but right now we need to get it out there. The topic about 44 some odd people being laid off from Holy Cross Hospital. Our council meeting was filled with people with questions and concerns, and here to answer them, whether you want to write me, and I'll be checking my email throughout, and I apologize to our guests for being a little distracted because I told people they could do that anonymously, because there's a bit of a culture of fear, I'm going to say it. People have told me they don't want to speak up because they don't want to be the nail that sticks up. They don't want to lose their jobs. Okay, fair enough. We have somebody already on hold who has a question about what's going on. CEO of Holy Cross Hospital, Peter Hofstetter, front and center. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with me.
Thanks. Nice to be here. I'm trying to figure out where the breakfast is, though.
I know. I've been trying to figure that out for almost 4 years, and I don't know, unless we bring it. Dr. Loretta Ortiz-Pino, also the chief medical officer, joining us also to field some questions today.
Absolutely. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning. And, you know, rumor, it's a small town. When we get a hit like this, it's expected. I've seen this before, so I say we go right after it. And I had somebody on hold for a while. I'm going to take him right off the bat. And I think, if I have it right, Martha Jaramillo, are you our first guest this morning?
Yes, I am.
Great. And you have both CEO Peter Hofstetter, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Loretta Ortiz-Pino. What's your question this morning to kick off this layoff situation? What's going on for you?
Well, I'm an ICU nurse at the hospital. I'm also the secretary of the nursing side of the union. And my question is, don't you believe that the community of Taos deserves to have a voice in the future of the hospital and in massive changes that come down the road without any warning? Don't you think this should be a collaborative effort to see what we can do to grow the hospital and to continue to keep our community hospital in Taos County?
And what do you mean by, and I'm asking for clarity. I've also heard that this seems very, like we didn't get much public notice about it as a community nonprofit hospital. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yes, I just think that because these changes affect the entire community, they should be discussed with the entire community so we can have input to try to come up with a good solution.
All right. So do you want to hang on for the answer, take it off air? How would you like to do this?
I can hang on.
All right. Well, I'm going to turn it down just a bit. I'll turn to Peter Hofstetter first, our CEO, to talk about that. And again, I'm echoing what I'm hearing. I've got tons of emails, people saying this is sudden. Why didn't we get more notice? Shouldn't we have more of a say?
Sure. No, and it's an understandable question. This is a horrible week. It's terribly emotional. Anytime there's, you know, layoffs, it's frankly the worst thing that any of us get to do. There's a couple of things. First off, I spent pretty much all summer with a series of PowerPoint presentations. I've been to all of the county government, the commissioners, and I've been to Cuesta, Red River, Ski Valley, Angel. I mean, we've been all over with this presentation, Lions Club. So we have been out talking about what we're doing. We have been doing a series of email surveys. We've been doing some focus groups. We've been doing a lot of public outreach. There's never enough when it comes to a layoff because, frankly, everybody has an opinion, as they should, because there's a certain amount of personal ownership when it's the only institution, the only hospital in the community. The problem becomes at the end of the day, there is a board, there is a management. You sit down and you look at what you need to do, and somebody ultimately has to make these decisions. It's not like, and I don't mean to make light of this in any sense, but it's not like you can put a ballot initiative and say, let's vote on this, because it's just not practical.
And I get that. And Martha, I've got another call. Did you have a follow-up there?
I do actually have one other unrelated question, if that's okay.
Sure.
In our department, 2/3 of our department was laid off on Monday. We do critical care, take care of the sickest patients. So more of those patients are now going to be shipped to Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Denver, other places, because we don't have room in the inn to take care of them. Do you think with Chairman of the Board Ron Burnham being the fire chief in Red River, that it's a conflict of interest for him to vote to make these cuts when now his ambulance service will be getting a lot more business?
Well, that's a good question, and either one of you want to field that. Thank you, Martha, for your call. And hang on one second. I just want to let people know, if you call here and you let it ring, and I know it'll only ring so many times, but try me back at 758-5868. There's been a lot of issues around the board, which right. We want to get to. The
sure.
lack of transparency, accusations, the stonewalling of legitimate questions, I have to say, that people have brought forth to this board, that they simply got nothing. And that's, as a member of the media, I have to tell you, I feel a little bit in the dark. This was a surprise. Either one of you want to feel the, first
sure.
of all, the conflict of interest possibility?
I think that's preposterous. I mean, I think you don't make, I mean, I can't even honestly believe that somebody would ask that question. You know, the reality is we make decisions in what we hope and we believe will be in the best interest of the community and all of us. There's a higher level of responsibility of what you have to do. And I think one of the things that we struggle with, really there's a couple of things, but one of them is we've had a 5-bed ICU now for some period of time. We can tell you from a pure clinical standpoint, at any given time, 2.3, whatever the number is, are quote-unquote true ICU patients. The rest of those beds were used for medical surgical patient overflow. They were used for convenience. They were used for a variety of things. So what we tried to do is figure out in a balanced sort of way is what do you do? And the reality is we are stuck, as are most health institutions right now, with a series of very difficult, not terrific decisions. Do you close an ICU? Do you get out of the OB business? Do you not have certain specialties? Do you shrink hours? Do you not do outreach? You know, and I can go down a whole list. And the question is, how do you figure out what the best balance is while still being able to provide a level of services that are high quality and that serve the vast majority of the community? And the problem is the system right now just will not allow hospitals to be all things to all people.
Taking the scare out of health care. Peter Hofstadter, CEO from Holy Cross Hospital, will have more on this topic on Breakfast with Nancy. Keep it here, 1340 KVOT Taos. The buzz about town, not only today, but even yesterday and the day before that, people worried about their jobs at the hospital. And, of course, the stories today in the Taos News are are talking about it, folks in the street last night, meetings I was at. What will happen? I'm not sure if my wife will have a job after so many years. Big cuts coming from Holy Cross Hospital. Well, there are some cuts coming. That is true. But we thought we should talk directly to the CEO, Peter Hofstetter, about what's actually going on. So we're doing that. And Peter, thanks for talking to us this morning. I appreciate it. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I know you, you've been up for a while, and I was happy that I was able to reach you and just address some of the concerns, because people last night, as I mentioned at a meeting I was at and around town, are saying, I don't know, you know, I'm not even sure if I have a job. What's going on with these cuts? This isn't a big surprise. You talked about it actually on the last show you were on with me. It's a little more specific, though, that they're actually coming down the line.
Yeah, it is. And as you mentioned, we have talked about it. You know, I've been doing a series of, you know, conversations around the county for the last 2 months. I mean, we're just, as we've said, we've seen a $15 million decrease in reimbursement, and that's all Medicare and Medicaid and associated program related. It has nothing to do with, you know, frankly, anything anybody's done. It's just continuing cuts, including things like the sequester. And we just, in order to respond to those, just have to reduce our costs of doing business. And that's, unfortunately, when personnel is 50-60% of your expenses. And so we are, you know, looking very seriously at all of our overheads, all of our costs, all of our departments. And we're in the final stages, you know, over the next few days of sorting out exactly what we'll do. And we'll sit down Monday with the union and sort of walk through, you know, all of the things that we plan to do. I can tell you that we are looking, there is nothing that is a sacred cow, so to speak. We're looking, I know one of the things is it always nurses or is it always clinical? And the answer to that is no. We are looking at administration. We're looking at, you know, literally every department to see where we can create efficiencies and where we can, you know, get on top of things. And it's a horrible decisions to have to make because it's people and it's people's lives. So I completely understand that. But the current environment just requires that hospitals, you know, frankly, trim their costs and be able to afford to live within these new healthcare rules.
And some of this you are, I mean, you've talked about before, we happen to live in a community that has a very high uninsured and a low reimbursement rate. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. It's not that the reimbursement rate is low, although in some cases it is. It's we have large numbers of Medicare, Medicaid, and uninsured. So consequently, those payers, those ways that we get paid are less than, say, a Blue Cross or a United or a Presbyterian or Loveless Insurances. So, yeah, our what we call our payer mix is on the lower end, and that's no one's fault. It's just what the demographics are.
Now, when you talk about cuts, we at this point, we don't know. You're looking at every department. You just laid that out.
Yep, absolutely.
How many jobs are we looking at? A dozen? Two dozen? I mean, what is this going
to
look like?
I mean, to be absolutely honest with you, I don't know, because we're literally just trying to finish all that up. And we have an obligation legally and I think ethically as well to sit down with our union first and, you know, walk through what we're going to do before we make any of that public. I think that, you know, an obligation we have. The rumors are difficult enough, and, you know, it's obviously difficult for the employees that are here, but we're trying to finish those up over the next couple of days, figure out what we're doing. We'll sit down on Monday and go from there.
And the Monday meeting will be with members of the National Union of Hospital.
We've been represented for a number of years by 1199, and so we have, as it turns out, we have a monthly what we call labor management meeting, and it's, you know, our staff with the union folks, and we, you know, go through issues, and frankly it's always been a very positive relationship, and the natural next meeting is this coming Monday, so we'll sit down with them and walk through where we are.
And has this come from basically the board to you? Are these the decisions coming from members of the board?
Well, I think the board is the ultimate decision maker, but as the administration, as the management here, we sit down and say, gosh, you're losing money, you can't do this, you can't do this. So we will make recommendations to the board, and they'll approve or disapprove. So that's how the board doesn't say you have to do this or you have to do that, although it's clearly their right to do that if they wanted to. But it's recommendations that come from management.
And I know there have been some concerns about the length of time board members stay on the board. I'm not familiar with how other boards work, but some of these folks have had some long tenure. Is this normal? Is this something you'll be looking at? I know that there have been some people saying, hey, yeah, we should move it around a little bit.
Well, no, it's a great question, and it's a conversation that goes on in the nonprofit world continuously. I mean, I've been at this over 30 years. We have a 13-member board. I think, you know, that it's well representative of the community. We have folks from, you know, all over Taos County, Penasco, Cuesta, Red River, up in the Ski Valley, the town. So, you know, it's a really good representation. And I think in the 4 years that I've been here, probably close to half, I'd have to count, but there's a good number that are brand new, you know, in the last 3 or 4 years. But we do have some long-term members, and I think the question you have to ask yourself, if they're good, productive members, then frankly, that experience and that institutional memory, I think, is important for a board to have. I mean, I'm sure you've been on boards, and many of your listeners have, and it's important to have sort of a connection to things that have happened in the past. These are, you know, I don't mean to make light of it, but this is not like, Senator Byrd or some of those folks in the Senate where they wheeled them in and propped them up to vote. These are all folks that are very dedicated, hardworking, and spend a fair amount of time, you know, helping to guide the hospital. And I think having that institutional memory is important, especially in a community, you know, as old as ours.
We're talking with CEO for Holy Cross Hospital, Peter Hofstetter, is the buzz, of course, and this is about people's jobs, and people at this moment, many at Holy Cross, don't know if they're on the list or not. Now, the other question I had for you is, some people are saying, well, if we knew that it was this dire, shouldn't we have been brought into the conversation earlier? A lot of nurses are saying we're willing to compromise rather than be cut. What would you can you respond to
yeah,
that?
Yeah, sure, I can. I would suggest to you that it's not, quote-unquote, that dire. I would suggest to you that what we're trying to do is be proactive so that it doesn't become dire. You can look at the horizon, and you can see. I mean, we've got a massive political mess in Washington with this debt ceiling conversation that's going to start next week, and there are billions of healthcare dollars at risk there that we have no idea what will be paid or what we won't. Right now, as of today, we still don't know how we'll be paid from the state for Medicaid as of January 1st, and it's already September. And so I think it would be, we would not be doing our management the right way if we didn't try to be proactive to what's going on in Washington and Santa Fe. And I would argue, rather than, frankly, I understand the emotional part because whenever there's anybody's jobs, it's very difficult. I would suggest to folks that their energies ought to be put in Washington and Santa Fe with our elected officials. There are lots of financial issues that are going to be at risk coming forward, and I think this is not just healthcare. I mean, I think if you listen to communities about how they're funded, they also have similar issues. So
yeah, and I, as I mentioned, I'm happy that you've got a chance to answer some of these questions. We won't know what these jobs will amount to, but do you have a figure of what you have to cut from the budget?
Well, you know, right now we're looking at, and I hate to give you numbers because then that's what becomes permanent, but we're looking at trying to cut some $2 to $2.5 million worth of expenses. But remember, we're also trying to build business, and you know, we have new general surgery. We have a lot of what I think are very encouraging signs of good things. So we're just, you know, this is going to be a struggle in healthcare, and not that this helps people locally, but you know, all of the newsletters I get from, you know, national organizations, I mean, there are unfortunate reductions all over the country right now. It's a very difficult healthcare environment. It's very tough right now.
Peter Hofstadter joining us from Holy Cross Hospital. And lastly, will we see any particular services, dialysis or any kinds of specific medical treatments that we won't have available to us that maybe we do now?
The answer to that is absolutely not. The service side of things, we're not looking to. I know the paper was quoted, we're closing services. We're not looking at closing services.
So you're not looking at closing services.
Now, will we look at changing things? Can you be more efficient? Can you do things differently? Absolutely. And I would argue that there isn't a business in the world that doesn't do that from time to time.
All right.
We're not looking at closing.
Well, I'm sure we'll have more questions, but I appreciate it. At least 10 minutes to talk a little bit about a story that will affect a lot of people. How many employees do you have at the hospital?
Well, if you count all the, you know, physician practices and all that, it's 400. And, oh, gosh, I guess it's in the 470 to 480 range, something right around there.
And, again, a percentage of those, the workforce, reduction, what are you looking at?
I honestly don't know, Nancy. Okay. I'm not trying to be evasive. We're just trying to put all those numbers together. But I can assure you we are looking at literally top to bottom, management, every department. So we're trying to figure out what can we do and, you know, still provide the high-quality care that we provide.
And for those employees in the community, when do you think we'll have a definitive word on how that will...
I'm hoping to get all this squared away next week.
Next week. Okay, and next week?
Because otherwise it's sort of torture to everybody.
And we will be having you on for a special, I know, next Friday,
yep.
And we can even make more time for you,
okay,
if you like. I want to thank you for taking a little time this morning.
My pleasure. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Yep. CEO from Holy Cross Hospital, Peter Hofstadter, as people this morning are wondering about their jobs. A lot to cover, so don't go away. 1340 KVOT Taos.
Concerned. My understanding is they laid off all the ICU aides. And also the ones from the unit, the observation unit, or whatever they're calling that unit. And then they laid off the techs that watched the cardiac monitors. My mother was in the hospital a few months ago, and her life was saved by one of those techs watching those monitors. How do they expect the nurse to take care of 4 to 6 patients and watch a monitor?
That's a very good question. And you know what? I want to say thank you. Do you want to hang on for your answer?
I would like to hang on.
All right. What I'm going to do is just pot you down a little bit. That means turn your volume down because I get feedback. But you're there. Trust me.
Okay.
And I'll be able to hear you. Just hang with me. You are echoing a number of calls I got yesterday and people mm-hmm. saying they didn't get that right. And, of course, they're calling me. I'm not, first of all, you guys, I'm not involved with the hospital in any way other than I'm glad it's there when I need it, and I've had people there. So I don't know what the people are talking about, but people did say this: you got it all wrong on this. Mm-hmm. Loretta, they said that, you know, gosh, we, you know, this is dangerous. We can't do it. It's a life-saving thing. So clarity on that issue?
Sure. And probably what I need to do is explain when a patient has any kind of a condition where they're in a room and a nurse can't be in there with them, a really wonderful tool that we have now with technology is a monitor that they can be remotely viewed for their heart rate, their respiratory rate, and sometimes their oxygen saturation.
Most of us have seen it.
You know, absolutely.
You get hooked up to it, and if anything goes wrong, it usually beeps, doesn't it?
It does, and it has an alarm.
Okay.
So prior to about 6 months ago, the ICU, which had at that time 6 beds, and then we went to 5 beds, had its nursing staff, and they had aides. And then there was a bank of monitors, mm-hmm. And there was a tech assigned to that. So it was in a room, and if anybody's been at Holy Cross Hospital, it's not a large room, but it's a central area with 6 beds surrounding it.
Mm-hmm.
Every room is visible from the nursing station. Mm-hmm. Every patient there is on a monitor. But also patients out on med-surg who, if you've been at the hospital, all of those rooms are spread around, and each of those patients may or may not be on a monitor. And then there's the ER where patients have their nursing staff, and then there's some rooms where they may need to be monitored. At the time when we felt we could expand services, and because of some advice that we got, it was felt that it would be best to have all of that monitoring done in one unit. So we built a special unit where all of those patients could be remotely monitored in one room, okay,
mm-hmm.
which sounds like a wonderful thing, and it was. Subsequently, what we found, though, is that with this shift and the changes and cutting our ICU down to where we have only two beds, and then we moved our observation unit in there, that bringing the monitoring back into that space provided two things. One is the staff in there can, most of the time, they're in there, if they're taking care of their patients, they need to be able to hear those monitors. They're all alarmed, so that if somebody has an arrhythmia or any change in their status, that alarm will monitor. There's also monitors which we call, for lack of a better word, slave monitors, and those have always been there on med-surg and in the emergency room, mm-hmm. so that alarms go off in both places, because there's lots of... There's lots of situations where if a nurse is tied up, they can't see their patient in their own room.
But they can hear this alarm.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So obviously, I think that whenever you take a service away, people are fearful that we've now created an unsafe situation. But this is exactly the situation that we had before. We've always had monitoring of our patients. We just didn't have them all together in one room.
Mm-hmm.
We still have the slave monitors where nurses can hear the alarms, and the nurses who are in charge of their own patients also are aware of what's going on with their patients.
All right. And I'm going to give you one follow-up there, and I saw that someone else was calling. So did you want to comment another follow-up?
Okay, so you're telling me that the monitor will sound not only in the area where, but also on the medical surgical department where that nurse's patient actually is.
Yes.
They'll have an alarm sounding too?
Absolutely. And they always have. When we developed the monitored room where everybody was in, we turned those monitors off because there was somebody designated. But those monitors are now back on, and at each of the nursing stations, if a patient's on a monitor, it will go off at that point.
All right, and I thank you. We do have another call coming in. Gosh, you guys are early birds. Good for you, and you've got questions. And that's why you are here.
Yeah.
Well, you did. 758-5868. I'm sorry, you don't go away. Let me tell you how it works here. We have a blinking light. I have two lines, and I will see you, and I will get to you as quickly as I can. So for the person who just called, I'm sorry that you hung up. Stay online. 758-5868 is the number, 758-5868, with CEO Peter Hofstetter and our chief, I'm going to get this right, medical officer, Dr. Loretta Ortiz-Epino, joining us too. And you can ask some questions as you just did. So it sounds like you're going back to a system. Yeah, it's probably going to make, I mean, whenever you take away something, you have to spread that work around
yes.
to somebody else. There's some fear about that, I'm sure.
Yeah, and then that's what I think we were talking about yesterday is because of the financial constraints that we have, we are having to cut back and get leaner and get more efficient with the staff that we have. We are asking every single person to work a little bit harder, but not to the point where we're compromising patient safety. That's the bottom line. There's none of the changes that we made do we feel there's patient safety compromise. And we will be continuing to monitor on a daily basis how are things going. If situations come up or something comes up that we feel maybe we need to make some adjustments, we are going to be very flexible and make sure that things are constantly being monitored to make sure our patients are getting safe, quality care.
All right. Now we have two calls, and I can only take one at a time, so here you go. You're on the air. Good morning. Good morning. Are you there?
I am, yeah.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks. I just had a couple of things. First of all, about the monitors. I work as a nurse, and I know that while those alarms do go off, and we hear them consistently throughout the day, we depend on the techs to actually let us know, kind of differentiate between a monitor that's going off because an oxygen saturation has fallen a little bit below the norm, as opposed to a cardiac arrhythmia. Those monitors, I think like anything else that you just kind of hear consistently, they're very easy to tune out after a while. And so it's a little different to have a human being with eyes on the monitor who can actually give you a shout when something big is going on and say, hey, no, you actually need to pay attention to this. And actually, I had one other question for Peter, just more on the financial end of things, which is that I keep hearing all of this discussion around Obamacare and how that's basically forcing these changes to happen, but that's not the only relevant new kind of national legislation for this discussion. CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who reimburse us for a lot of our services, is also doing a lot of restructuring, and what they're doing is denying reimbursement to hospitals for hospital-acquired infections or bed sores or any sort of preventable complication, and they're not only denying payment for that stay, but any readmission that's related to that. And those are exactly the kinds of complications that increase when you cut staffing. There's a lot of research that's readily available that shows that cutting staffing is actually a very short-term financial solution, because what you tend to see are increases in these types of complications that, again, Medicare and Medicaid will not pay for, and I think private insurers are not going to be far behind.
Well, if I can, I'm going to keep you for a moment, because you're in the trenches and I'm not. Do you believe there's a financial shortfall?
Sure. I'm sure there is. I mean, I don't work at Holy Cross. I used to. Intimately familiar with the staff and, you know, with kind of the situation there.
I got you. And just a quick follow-up then. How would you have handled this? I mean, what do you think would be a better way? You got to make cuts.
Sure.
These are the folks charged to do it. What would you have done?
Well, I mean, I'll say this. I am not that long out of nursing school, and so during the course of that, I worked at a number of hospitals in New Mexico. I currently work at a hospital in Albuquerque, and in all of the hospitals that I've seen and been involved with, I have never seen, patients being served salmon and asparagus for dinner. I've never seen the sorts of technology. I work at the only
Are you saying that Holy
Center?
Okay, are you saying that's what we serve at Holy Cross?
I'm saying the food is phenomenal, which is awesome, and I think, you know, an important thing that needs to change, but the expenditure I can't even imagine.
Okay, I mean, and I know this is a broad, and I realize I'm asking you a big question, but I think you answered it. It's the way the cuts are going.
Exactly, okay. And that's just it. I mean, it's, and I'm not saying that, you know, by skimping on food they can retain staff. I'm saying that expenditures just across the board are out of control, and there's been a number of technological advancements that, you know, the nursing staff has been asked about, said, no, we don't want that. They're put into place anyway.
Can you name one? Can you tell us one? Hold on. Tell me one.
The new telemetry units.
All right. Now, I'm gonna leave it there because I've got some other calls, 758-5868. There's a lot there. But jump in, either one of
you. Sure. A couple of things. First, the easy one is the food. We have, as we talked yesterday, we are part of a large national group purchasing associations. And to be honest with you, the cost of providing the food, whether it's, I'm sort of making light of this, but whether it's peanut butter and jelly or whether it's salmon is negligible. I mean, there really isn't a significant cost because of the way you buy food through these pre-negotiated contracts. And that's the beauty of, as we talked yesterday, one of the things with Quorum is we get access to some of these contracts, and we've saved, as I said, $400,000-$600,000 a year on purchasing. I think our other point, which is a really, really good point, is the whole idea of the payment stuff. It is really complicated, and there's a lot of, without trying to confuse everybody, there's a lot of parallel things happening. Right now, we're being pushed to do everything short stay out patient sort of headset, but yet you're still paid in some different ways. And I think her whole idea, her whole point of readmissions and all that is a very frustrating thing for us because we have a lot of frail elderly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this has, frankly, nothing to do with the medical care as much as it does with what support systems do they have at home. Can they get to a doctor's appointment? Are they getting their medications? Are they, you know, all those things. And what ends up happening is the person gets sick. It doesn't get good, you know, care at home, and then ends up coming back sooner, and then we get penalized because there's a readmission. There's clearly some correlation with staffing, of course, but there's a lot of other pieces that fit in that bucket.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a sort of a systemic problem with
our entire,
and we've talked about this medical system.
Nancy, can I say one thing?
Yeah, let me just tell this person to hang on. Good morning. I do have you. Hang on, okay? Are you with me?
I'm hanging on.
All right. Don't go away.
I think the key thing, and she was right in that if you don't have adequate staff, you do have to worry about things like bed sores and problems. We have adequate staff. We've not changed the staffing on MedSurg. There are plenty of nurses for the number of patients that we have, and if our census goes up, we will adjust to that. But she's correct in saying if you don't have adequate staff, you have to worry about those problems starting to creep up. But we have systems in place for monitoring and tracking, and we have adequate staff on our MedSurg.
The other thing, too, just kudos to the staff. I mean, we just were recognized for over a year without any pressure ulcers, without any sores. Our infection rates have consistently, for years, been not only low, but lower than national averages. So I think that's a lot of kudos to the staff and their hard work and what they're doing.
I see you calling. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. As most people know, MD hospitalists make rounds at the hospital on the patients instead of their primary care doctor making rounds as the system used to be. I would like to know, what is the salary of these hospitalists? Is the hospital making money or losing money on this? And if they're losing money, why not get rid of the hospitalists and have the doctors make their own rounds again? But I would really like to know what the hospitalist salaries are and if the hospital is making money on this.
Good question. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And let me just do this really quick thing. I'm going to ask you to hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right. That one. Hospitals.
Sure.
Okay.
No,
Who are they and why not have the doctors make their own rounds?
Right. Well, there's a couple of things to talk about here. First off, the hospitals we have are just outstanding clinicians. I mean, in most cases, they are physicians that practiced here in private practice, either at the Taos Medical Group or family practice, and then just decided not to do the private practice thing. And it's just a change in medicine. I'm not here to argue one way or the other on how, whether it's a good system or a bad system, but nationally it's been now 5, 6, 7 years where hospitalists really came into their own specialty. And what happened is, and it's somewhat financially driven, there are some very good clinical indications for hospitalists. But the idea is that you have a physician that's in the hospital, he or she sees you, and there's consistency because it's the same hospitals for 2 or 3 days in a row versus potentially in a private practice, you might get whoever is on call that day. So you could see Dr. Smith one day, Dr. Jones the next day, that kind of thing. And so what happened is the physicians found that they could make more money. They could be paid better to stay in their offices and see patients, you know, consistently throughout a day than to get their days interrupted, go to the hospital, have to bump patients around or cancel patients and all that stuff. So it's a combination of those things. And I can tell you absolutely, absolutely with certainty that we would be hard-pressed to get any of our physicians to come back into the hospital and get back into that whole call thing. By having the hospitalist there, remember, somebody's there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it does, frankly, save the private physicians from having to come in and take call and all those things. So it's just a change in the system. As far as making money on those, we do end up subsidizing that, which is pretty typical in hospitals.
All right. So to her original question, would you save money by having the doctors come in? And
I think the bigger point is at this stage, we have to also look at our community and our physicians in our community who are also excellent in private offices, because I think a lot of people get confused. Most of the physicians who have their practices are private practices. There's a few of the practices in town that are owned by the hospital, but those physicians struggle every day to make ends meet. Healthcare, especially in a rural community, is very, very difficult. So if those physicians had to work full day in their office and then come into the hospital, my fear is we would lose many of them. Right. I was in that position for 25 years as a pediatrician. If I had a full schedule in my office and I suddenly had to go into the hospital to see a patient, mm-hmm. the ones that were in the office lost out. I had to reschedule them or see them later. So it's a nationwide system. We're doing what's standard of care. And in all honesty, I think our patients are happier because there's a doc in that hospital with them all the time, whereas if the private docs had to come in, they would be there maybe 5 minutes in the morning and 5 minutes in the afternoon.
All right. Good morning. You're on the air. And do you have a question or comment?
Yes, back to the hospitalist. When I was in the hospital, I saw a different hospitalist every day.
I think that's very possible, but most of the time they try to schedule themselves in a series of three days.
Could we be told what the hospitalists are paid?
I don't think that's a really appropriate conversation to have at this point.
What's the national average?
Yeah, I don't even know what I think the national average is probably up in the, I'd have to say high hundreds-ish or so.
A year.
So you're not going to be transparent and tell us what Holy Cross is paying its hospital.
Well, it's not a question of transparency. I think these are personnel issues, and what somebody's salary is.
You're saying the national average is around $100,000 a year?
No.
Hundreds.
Hundreds of thousands.
It's closer to 200.
200 thousands. And I can tell you our hospitals do not make the national average.
Okay, you're saying the national average is $200,000 a year.
That's what I said, high hundreds.
Yeah,
but that we're not paying that. But that's as close as we can get. I'm sorry, that's the answer we have. We got another call coming. I'm kind of surprised that people are up early. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
You have
a question. Is for Peter.
Okay.
I know he said that he didn't receive any bonuses from Holy Cross Hospital in the past several years, but do you receive bonuses from Quorum for making all these cuts?
I don't receive. I just get a flat salary.
You don't receive bonuses from Quorum?
Nope, I do not.
Okay.
I've persistently heard this. So where is this going? Well, she's gone.
Well, I know where it came from.
I don't.
If you looked at the 990 that the paper published from 2010,
yeah.
There was a $10,000 bonus thing. But what that really was is part of my moving expenses when I came here in 2009.
Why did they put moving expenses? It saved us a whole lot of conversation.
You have to talk to the IRS. I don't have a clue.
All right. 758-5868 is the number. I know we only have a few minutes left, and there are going to be a couple of forums coming up, and there are obviously a lot of questions. Sometime I'd like to have a conversation about what we're just talking about. We've got some huge systemic issues regarding healthcare, not the least of which when I just hear you say we're being punished for people who return because they don't have good aftercare, maybe for reasons that aren't their fault or mm-hmm. the hospital's
exactly.
fault.
Exactly.
And this is huge. We have an aging population that's going to need more and more assistance. I have story after story that I stacked up I haven't even gotten to about what this may mean for the future of healthcare. And we're going to have to make some changes as a community and as individuals. And my hope is that with this new, call it Obamacare, I like it, care, anything with the word care in it is good with me if it really means that. Preventative care. I mean, I'm with you. I mean, the most expensive care we get, and I always get so, I tense up when I hear people say this. I'm sure it happens when people go to the emergency right. room, but for the most part, people are doing that because they did not have the insurance to get the preventative
yes.
care
right.
they needed in the first place. They're not bad people,
no.
you know, or ne'er-do-wells who are just, you know, taking advantage of the system. Sure, there are always going to be some people like that, but it kind of, you know.
Which is why we have very wonderful outpatient services and our commitment, because as inpatient services, the demand for them start decreasing, we want to be there to be able to fill those outpatient requirements, you know, to do home visitations, to do wound care clinics, to keep people out of the emergency room,
right.
you know, our Coumadin clinic. It's a magnificent clinic that keeps people from having to go into the emergency room.
And I'm a little confused. Urgent care is not yours.
The urgent care in town is not. But we are looking at, as we've talked before, we're looking at creating a occupational medicine practice, which would be, I think, a big help to all of our local, you know, employers, businesses, ourselves included. Part of that will be an urgent care center.
It's, I think, a concept we have to move toward. I know I talked about this yesterday, making nurse practitioners, pharmacists, more capable. They can already, they're already knowledgeable. Get these people out of there. We don't want, frankly, we don't want to go to the emergency room.
Well, and as you know, we use not just the hospital, but all of the practices in town use a lot of what we call mid-levels, nurse practitioners, PAs. Our pharmacists are out. John Hutchinson, who is a pharmacist, runs the Coumadin Clinic. He also runs all the prescription
assistance programs.
And I think he told me we're someplace up around $2 million worth of prescription assistance that we've provided through these programs. So there's some really cool stuff that's happening.
Well, and I think there's going to be more. Now, I will tell you, if you want more, you can tune in across the hall. I think you're heading to our sister stations, 95.9, and also over at 99.1 Radio Exodus. We're going to end it here. We need to. We've got to get over to ABC News. We've got a couple of forums coming up next Wednesday.
11:30 or noon at...
at the Solar Center.
And then at 4:30 or 5:30 at Kit Carson.
All right. And we'll do more.
Today.
CEO from Holy Cross Hospital. Now, today there is a meeting. It is, I'm trying to let our public know, our folks know, our listeners. This isn't really a place to come and spout off, I don't think. It's more of a brainstorming session. Am I right? Well, you tell me about today's meeting.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think, the commission, we've had work sessions with the commissioner, in the past, and it's a nice opportunity to sit down, if you will, in a semi-casual environment and just walk through the issues. And I think they've invited the town council and the mayor, and we'll sit, talk through where we are, what's going on. And I think the timing for this is actually quite good, because if, your listeners are following what's going on in Washington right now with the potential government shutdown and then the debt ceiling talk, there's a literally billions of dollars of health care funding that's sort of caught up in all of that as well.
No kidding. 6 days and counting. I can't think of worse timing. I mean, my only hope is people will come to their senses. But will this...
This is the Congress. You're asking a lot.
I know. I feel like sometimes, just Mary Lala over here, Mary Sunshine. Shutting down the government, though, it says... Well, I'm reading several articles. Wouldn't affect the health care law, at least for people who don't have insurance. It might for others. I'm so confused about the whole thing. In your mind, though, if the government gets shut down, what happens to Holy Cross immediately?
Nothing will happen immediately. The shutdown in and of itself won't do anything. As you know, though, the core or the reasoning behind the shutdown is a number of the Republicans want to defund Obamacare, which, is potentially a big deal for all of us come the first of the year. I think the bigger issue is, I think they tell you, whatever it is, October 18th or something, when we hit the debt ceiling, there are literally billions of dollars of health funding caught in that, because the government has never found any permanent solutions to funding. And what they do is they, on a year-to-year basis, renew a funding. Like there's a physician payment thing. There's what we call low volume. There's a whole pile of things. And so for Holy Cross Hospital in particular, we have, millions of dollars that are potentially at risk, depending on how those negotiations go. And frankly, it's true of every hospital in the country. I mean, everybody's got a slightly different piece of that pie. But that to me is, some fairly serious things. The sequester is still up in the air. Is that going to be extended through January? So there's lots of issues out there.
There are, and they all are making, they will affect everything from our hospital to all kinds of services if they should happen. But I can't even second guess what's going on there.
It's not worth trying.
But back to our healthcare system. Yeah. I mean, I think that was one of the things I asked you when you were here. Is, well, couldn't we have waited? Wouldn't Obamacare actually help in the long run? And I think that your answer was paraphrasing a bit, but you couldn't, you really couldn't wait that long.
No, I don't think you could. I mean, I think there's two or three things, as I've said all along, going on. One is, you know, to date, we've seen a $15 million shrinkage in what we're paid. We know that our costs couldn't support that reduction in payment, and then you have all this new what if out there. So it was really a question of trying to be responsible and think, you know, forward and be proactive as to what's happening.
And that is what you're trying to do. Will you also be putting forth your plans and then seeing what perhaps our elected officials, the town of Taos, the mayor, council, and our county commissioners can do, too. We have an unusual situation, and a lot of people are confused about it. The county does not own, well, maybe you should explain it. They do have a part in this. There is a partnership, but how does that work?
Yeah, the county owns the physical building and the land. The Taos Health Systems, Inc., or Holy Cross Hospital is a private 501c3 private not-for-profit organization. So we technically rent space from the county.
So
it's our own business, if you will. It's the board's own business, but the county obviously played a role. And these are things that were done back in the early 80s when, you know, we were making plans to move from the old hospital to a new place, and here we are.
So does that mean you pay rent on the building?
Yeah, technically.
Okay, so that is something maybe, I don't know, they can work with, but the county is saying the same thing. We're having financial problems.
Oh, I don't think we're at odds over that. I think, you know, anytime you do something as dramatic as, you know, layoffs or things like that, the reductions, it's, you know, it's a very difficult situation, and I think the county, you know, it's jobs, it's, you know, we're all sort of tied together, you know, in those issues. And I think everybody wants to do the right thing. Everybody has, you know, been, you know, certainly frustrated and emotional and angry about, you know, reductions. But I think fundamentally everybody wants a good, strong hospital, and that's our goal as well.
Now, just on that, emotionally and the job losses, are you still in meetings with communication with and coming to some sort of agreement with union members? Is that still going on?
No, we're pretty well done. There was, you know, an odd, what they call bumping or two, you know, based on seniority and union rights. We're pretty well, you know, moving forward and trying to, you know, get things back on track and sorting everything out and moving forward, which is what we need to do. We did finally, it was like 6 o'clock Friday evening or something. We did finally get some drafts of contracts that will help us, you know, begin to enroll people in the new expanded state Medicaid program and all that. So those are contracts that will allow some of the companies in Albuquerque to pay some of our people to, you know, begin to do the education and outreach and all that. So there are some signs of good things happening. It was unfortunately supposed to happen in July, but here it is today, and it has nothing to do with us. It's just the system. So, you know, we're trying to move forward and get things going.
And lastly, just having to do with us, I think the average person will, I think I had Pavel on yesterday, and he said, gosh, I went to get blood drawn, and it took me, you know, much longer than usual, and like an hour, which I've never had that experience. So I guess for the patient or the person who uses the hospital for a variety of reasons, and I know you've said there'll be no disruption in healthcare, and certainly I understand that is part of your job, is to reassure people.
Right.
But when you look at the losses, I want to be realistic. Might we see longer lines? What kinds of things might we be looking at as customers?
Yeah, honestly, we didn't change anything in the lab or anything in X-ray. And to be honest, I guess while I don't like people waiting an hour, I would say in the positive sense, gosh, does that mean we were just extra busy yesterday because it was a Monday?
Yeah, I don't even know if it was yesterday. It was,
yeah.
But and it could have been, because I've never had that experience either.
Yeah, no, I try to go early at 6:30, quarter to 7.
Right.
And you get in and out, but no, none of the staffing has changed in any of those places. And in fact, we had an orientation yesterday and had a new phlebotomist. That's a person that does the blood drawing, and so, you know, those things shouldn't have changed one bit. And I would I would have to look at the day, but I would only, in a good way, sort of guess, gosh, maybe we were extra busy.
So, but again, just saying, with 44 fewer people at a community hospital, what might we see as?
I don't think you will. You've seen a reduction in the ICU beds, but the day-to-day service stuff shouldn't change one bit.
Well, that would be something.
That's our hope. That's what we're trying to do.
All right. Well, as the dust settles, or if it does, and the meeting finishes today, maybe we'll check back in and see what kinds of plans we're looking at.
Glad to help you out.
All right. Thanks for talking to us. Peter Hofstetter, CEO. Yep. Thanks a lot. Holy Cross Hospital in another meeting and telling us with the layoffs of 44 people, we shouldn't really see any difference there. I wonder what the other 44 people did then, that there'll be no disruption. Or is it that people will, and we've seen that. I mean, come on. Since the quote-unquote recession that we had, certainly many companies and many people have seen this, and that is that more of us are doing more with less. And is that the case? Is that where we're moving? All right, we'll have to find out more. I don't know, but he did touch on some other things too. 1340 KVOT Taos.